From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on February 16th at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. You know what the temperature was that day? -2 degrees Fahrenheit. -2. The coldest recorded temperature in North Texas in 72 years, and it came from a winter storm that had covered three-quarters of the country in snow. Texas is not really used to snow, but snow wasn't the only problem. The combination of snow, wind, and cold caused a power crisis. In Texas, the power grid was not winterized, and it was dangerously vulnerable to the weather. Now, certainly you can argue that such a deep freeze in Texas is not a predictable event, but it's also an inevitable event at least once a decade based on the last several decades. The 2011 Groundhog Day blizzard caused similar power issues, and so the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission advised that Texas should update its power infrastructure. But this advisory was not mandatory, just voluntary, and Texas didn't really do it. As a result, more than 4.5 million homes and businesses went without power for days in Texas, and the storms persisted. More than 70 people died in the cold. Wealthier families flew out of state or even out of the country. But most Texans were on their own. And now Texas regulators say that power companies can keep the excess profits they made during the crisis. As reported this week by journalist David K. Johnston, quote, Texas electricity producers charged an extra $47 billion during the February 14th through the 19th freeze. Only $10 billion of extra charges were imposed in all of 2020. And it turns out that a third of these new extra charges were bogus. Yet amazingly, Texas regulators plan to keep the $16 billion they improperly overcharged, end quote. Johnston writes that this is a story of politics, influence, and favoring wealthy companies instead of average citizens. The overcharges were so massive, Johnston writes, that they amount to an average of $550 for every Texan in the state. Steal $550 from a single person in Texas, and you are facing long criminal penalties. Steal $550 from every Texan. Johnston writes that for the current leadership, it's apparently just fine. What lessons should we draw from this? And by the way, how is our own energy grid faring? What are the regulatory rules that get routinely broken and why? And what remedy is there for both taxpayers and citizens who end up losing out? Our guest is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and the editor-in-chief of DC Report, David K. Johnston. Welcome back to Connections.
Well, glad to be here. And that was a solid introduction, Evan. Absolutely solid.
Well, and you know, our listeners are going to ask you later this hour about a couple of things related to the previous president, given your work chronicling him. But before we even get elsewhere, I do want to start in Texas and your work there, because DC Report has been chronicling what's been happening all throughout there. Tell me the story as you see it, David K. Johnston, because when you hear from political leaders, they have, you know, they're sort of casting a very different story. They are saying, well, maybe it was alternative energy that broke down. It was the Green New Deal's fault. New York State Senator Edward Rath told me earlier this week he's heard it was wind turbines that caused the problems down there. What is the story, David?
The story is that back in the 1990s, a company named Enron, a company that was built on fraud and tax evasion and hiding profits and bad financial practices, a company that eventually went bankrupt and took a lot of people with them and whose top executives were tried, sold a bill of goods. And unfortunately, half the states bought that bill of goods, including New York. Now, the important element to understand about this is that electricity is a unique product. It is created and used and therefore destroyed in the same instant. And so the traditional things we know about economics don't apply to electricity. In addition, electricity is what the modern world is. If you go to Pompeii or Herculaneum or the south of France and you walk the streets where the ancient Roman cities were, one of the things that quickly becomes apparent or should become apparent is they're just like modern shopping malls where everything is in walking distance, except there's no elevators. Their streets are very narrow because there are no automobiles. There's no night lighting except for fires because you need electricity for those things. No electricity, no gasoline cars, no jet airplanes, no radio, no internet. And in Texas, in particular, but we have this problem here in New York too, the system of what are called auctions, and I put auctions in quotes because they're not really what we think of in economics as an auction. They are by design going to cost consumers excess amounts of money, and their stated purpose, which is to get more electricity generators built, time has proven something I wrote 15 years ago to be correct. Instead of encouraging investment in more power plants, those auctions encourage buying a fleet of power plants and selectively shutting them down because that's the cheapest, most likely way to earn excess profits.
What does the phrase just and reasonable rates mean when it comes to electricity?
Well, historically, when electricity first came, it was a Wild West market. There are still street corners in some towns in Massachusetts that have eight power poles lashed together because eight different sets of competing power lines ran down the street. I mean, what a horrible thought. So the distribution of electricity, like the distribution of water and natural gas and the collection of sewage, is a natural monopoly. Well, how do you regulate these monopolies? Samuel Insull was the secretary to Thomas Edison when secretary meant he ran the company. And Edison got himself into one of many problems in his life because he was a genius inventor, but not a good person. And he pushed Insull onto his sword. Insull went west to Chicago, bought up a bunch of electric companies. Nobody thought he had any money. He walked away with a lot. And he quickly realized that he was having to meet politicians from every little town and city with their handout, wanting something from him. And so he came up with the idea of a state-level regulation of utilities. And the principle behind that was just and reasonable. Prices will be just and reasonable to consumers so they can afford electricity, whether it's for their home or for a manufacturing plant. And the investors, like Insull, are entitled to a just and reasonable profit, which would be set by regulators because in a monopoly, there is no market to set the price. So government acts as a proxy for the market through utility boards like the New York State Public Service Commission.
And when it comes to profit, even $1 more than earned is ostensibly supposed to be unjust and unreasonable, right?
That's right. Typically, the way traditional regulation worked, which isn't what Texas has anymore, and we largely don't have anymore in New York, is a company was told you get a certain return on your asset.
Right.
The typical return right now is around 10%. Even though bond interest rates have fallen a lot, it probably should be closer to 8%. It's stuck at 10, but that's what you're entitled to. So if you have $1 billion worth of assets in what's called the rate base, and your rate is 10%, you should get a profit of $100 million. If you get $100 million and $1, in theory, the $1 is unjust and unreasonable and should be dealt with in the next rate case. There's also another doctrine, which I didn't go into in the column, though, called the filed rate doctrine. If it turns out there was a miscalculation and the utility actually makes $110 million profit, so an extra $10 million, they get to keep it under normal circumstances, and the regulator should adjust for that going forward in the next utility rate case.
That's what they're supposed to do. And in Texas, you write that electricity producers charged an extra $47 billion in that week of deep freeze in mid-February. And the context I mentioned in the introduction, I'll say this again for listeners. In all of 2020, only $10 billion of extra charges were recorded and imposed. This was $47 billion in extra charges in 1 week, during a week in which 70 people died and people were scrambling to figure out how to stay warm and to stay alive. So take me through what happens next.
And on top, on top of that, Evan,
yeah,
the total volume of electricity produced was much lower than it normally would be. So if you want to look at it on a per unit of electricity, a megawatt hour, it's tremendously more money. The real problem is the market, but there's a second real problem, and that is under the rules of what's called the Texas Energy Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT, the emergency prices should have stopped at midnight on, I think it's February 18th. And instead, they continued for 33 more hours. That's the $16 billion or $550 per Texan. The rules provide for the first part of it, which is about $1,100 per Texan. But once the rule should have taken effect, then the money that was earned is absolutely unjust and unreasonable. And you can be sure there's going to be a lot of litigation over the fact that the ERCOT, the regulator, failed to properly properly implement the rule to stop these prices, which, by the way, were $9,000 an hour for electricity that costs to produce less than $100 an hour.
Okay. Now, the obvious question that listeners are drawing then is, well, there's clearly going to be some big penalties here. You can't overcharge in that way, and someone's going to hammer these companies. What's actually happened?
Yeah, well, it's not going to be the state of Texas and its politicians. Unfortunately, Texas, and I've been writing about that this problem was going to arise, and I've shown it on a smaller scale in the past from actual records. Texas is run by ideology. It is not run by science. It is not run by good market economics. It's run by ideology. And once someone like Governor Greg Abbott, who has a long history of using his office as attorney general, when he was the elected attorney general and now as governor, to do favors for his friends and tough luck to everybody else, they simply are not going to pay attention to these sound economic principles. And the problem I see for all of the 26 states that have Texas-like utility regulation, including New York, is that if we get away from the just and reasonable principle, what will happen is price gouging. It is inevitable. In fact, the markets, and the reason I call the auctions, auctions in quotes, that Enron designed are designed to raise prices. And there's a whole chapter in my book that I wrote in 2007, Free Lunch, about this, how Enron got this to happen and why we at, here in New York State are at risk because of the rules. New York State produces more electricity, Evan, than it uses. We are a net exporter of electricity, so we should have relatively low electricity prices. We don't. We have very high electricity prices. That tells you that the market is not driven by market economics and by competition, which is essential to capitalism. It is driven by corporate written policies to benefit the investors in these electric power companies.
Talking to David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor-in-chief of D.C. Report. And listeners, if you want to call the program as we talk about these and related subjects, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. On the subject of ideology, let me ask you about this narrative that some Texas politicians have done such a good job of talking about. I guess I was surprised before I even dug into the facts on this case, getting ready for the conversation with you, that a New York State Senator, Edward Rath, told us this week that his understanding was that it was wind turbines that caused the power outages and that it was alternative energy and a Green New Deal that hasn't even happened yet, which would be, I mean, that's a hell of a lot of power, David K. Johnston, for a deal that hasn't happened. But what do you think?
Yeah, one of the most astonishing things in this matter was when the problem began, we began hearing from Governor Abbott and others in Texas that it was the Green New Deal, which is just an idea. There is no Green New Deal. It's an idea. And then this issue of wind turbines. Well, wind turbines are running just fine in Canada, Iceland, Norway, Siberia, because they were designed and built for that kind of weather. You can build a cheaper turbine that is not designed for that kind of weather, and it'll shut down. But, well, Texas is one of the leaders in having wind turbine electricity because they have lots of open space and lots of wind. It's only a small fraction of the electricity in the state. The real reason there was a problem, first and foremost, was natural gas pipelines were not buried deep enough so that they didn't freeze up and the compressor equipment didn't freeze up. So there were natural gas-fired power plants that couldn't run for lack of fuel. Secondly, the grid wasn't designed to shift load from one place to another. You know, we need much more power in Austin and a lot less power in Dallas. It wasn't designed to handle those kinds of shifts in load, another way to cheapskate. And yet this idea that somehow it's the Green New Deal and whatnot has all over the place. And one thing I can tell you is it's likely the congressman watches Fox News because they've been a big promoter of this. And the facts just don't get in the way of things like that at Fox, except for, 3 o'clock in the morning. Oh, we made a mistake. Announcement.
Okay. So a couple other points here on this subject. The subject of preparation. So I want to read an email from a listener named Charles, who writes, not sure where this idea of a massive snowstorm in Texas being predictable is coming from. That's like saying that a tornado in New York is predictable. It's possible, but rarely ever takes place. And your funding for emergency preparedness, which you should have because the government exists to protect the border, not you specifically, is better spent elsewhere. Furthermore, there are cell phone providers which charge exceptionally low monthly rates for service. The trade-off is that you pay for the amount of data you use per month. That's the deal you make and the risk you assume. And it's as simple as that in this case with Texas, too. So Charles is saying, look, freak event. You can't predict it. You're not going to spend a ton of money preparing for something that's extremely unlikely. But as I mentioned at the outset, David, it was a decade ago for the Groundhog Day storm. There have been regulators telling Texas, look, with the vagaries of the weather and the vicissitudes of climate change, you might as well assume that once a decade you're going to have events like this and people could die if you don't deal with it. What is the expectation that we ought to have for preparation and what happened there?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right that Texas has been warned for at least all of the years of this century that its grid is not strong enough. Downtown Rochester's business district has one of the best electric grids in the country, or at least it did when we moved here in the early 90s, because Rochester Electric was locally owned and its board of directors were leading business figures in the community who understood how critical reliable electricity was. And so they saw to it that a redundant, solid grid was built to serve the downtown area. This went on all over the country, by the way, with really well-built grids in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Texas, by cheapskating it, decided we're going to run a risk. And I hope Charles thinks about this. The government officials who decide these things said, well, we're going to run a risk that we won't have severe weather. And we're going to place the cost, if we have miscalculated, not on the providers of electricity who we license, but on the customers who only have one place to go to get their electricity. That's not good economics. That's not good politics, I would think. Secondly, Texas has really shot itself in the foot about its effort to draw businesses away from Silicon Valley. Businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I used to work for both the LA Times and the San Jose Mercury long ago and was a homeowner, have a real serious problem. Housing prices are ridiculous. My very first house, a little three-bedroom, two-bath stucco tract house, sold for $2 million a couple of years ago. Workers can't afford that, even if they're making big salaries compared to the rest of the country. So Texas has been trying to attract digital industries to leave Silicon Valley and come to Texas. Mm-hmm. Well, digital industries require totally reliable electricity. And now that those industries know it's not totally reliable, Texas is not going to attract as many of those businesses. In fact, my guess is Idaho, which has a better grid, is looking real nice right now to some of those companies.
Interesting. Let me get a phone call from Liz in Rochester. I'm with David K. Johnston. Go ahead, Liz.
Hi. My question was getting back to how you had said earlier about that New York State's at risk because the because of the corporate underwriting. And how do we get that out? How do we change that? And how do we make the policy change back to, you know, being dictated by demand by the people instead of by corporate underwriting? I don't really understand the process behind that.
But thank you. I think I wasn't quite as clear as I should be. New York State uses electricity auctions just as Texas does. And it is the design of those auctions that can drive up prices. The number one problem in New York is that a great deal of our grid, the areas of national grid in particular, are foreign owned. So when you have local ownership of RG&E, for example, the people who were on the board of directors had the businesses that depended on RG&E. You got reliable power. When the owners of your company are in Barcelona, Spain, or in Great Britain, they just want their checks. They're not looking out for the welfare of the local community. And you remember that about 15 years ago, Steve Orr did an excellent piece in the Democrat and Chronicle about how we had all sorts of outages during one winter because of tree limbs falling during storms. And the response from Iberdrola, which was the parent company, was, oh, well, we're from Spain. We didn't know you had all these trees. Well, at the time I wrote, that is either a confession of absolute incompetence, since they clearly came here and could see trees, or they're lying. But take your pick, it doesn't matter. They shouldn't have what's called a certificate of public interest, convenience, and necessity to run this utility. They should have been removed right then. But we're stuck with them, apparently. And the real answer to your problem is to have municipal power. If you live in Fairport, you pay far less for your electricity than in Rochester. And everywhere in the country that we have nonprofit municipal power, you get all these benefits. They pay the same wages to their workers. They pay payments in lieu of the property taxes that are the same an investor-owned utility would have paid. They don't have super highly paid executives. Some of the utility executives now are making $30 and $40 million a year around the country. Their electricity is much more reliable. They have far fewer outages because their mantra is not maximizing profits, a perfectly legitimate thing to do and a proper thing to do in a competitive market, but not for a monopoly. They have much more reliability, and they're generally 15 to 30% cheaper. Why would you pay more and have money coming out of your community to go pay people who live in Spain, which is what we're doing?
Liz, does that help?
Yes, except for the part about how we can change that.
You've got to elect politicians who will listen and understand that. And there is no reason that the city of Rochester, for example, can't take over through condemnation the local electric utility. Jermaine Williams, the public advocate in New York City, that's an elected position in New York City, he's trying to take over Con Ed. It's very hard to do because utilities run campaigns. They actually have a guidebook on how to do it that I got a bootleg copy of, on how to trick people into believing that their local utility is better when it's more expensive and less reliable.
A couple other listener questions. Patrick says, Evan, to explore the subject, you have to touch on demand charges and who receives them. Typically, it's going to be businesses and large buildings that bear the brunt of demand charges, so the number might not be as high when assigned to the average Texan. Are we talking about demand charges during their crisis because a large portion of their electrical grid was down, making a bottleneck on energy and driving up demand, David?
Right. So electricity charges are broken when you have a market system clearly into two parts. You pay a charge to be connected to the grid, and then you pay for the amount of power that you receive. And in the auctions, when electric power plants go offline because they don't have natural gas fuel or they were cheaply built wind turbines that aren't spinning, then your charge is going to go up. And in Texas, the cap they put was $9,000. That's a tremendously high cap for a unit of electricity, a megawatt hour that costs less than $100 to produce. A much more reasonable cap would be the old Texas cap of $3,000, and even that would be horrendously expensive. And keep in mind, when these power plants went offline, less electricity was produced in Texas, and yet people are paying $47 billion more in charges.
That's how you hear about homeowners who end up with a massive bill, like a $16,000 bill. You know, those one-off right. stories, but they certainly pile up, and they are shocking to the people who get those bills, aren't they, David?
Yeah. Yes. And a lot of small business owners who have been struggling terribly with the pandemic are going to be hit by these. Manufacturers may earn a very good profit for the owner based on their assets, but on the sales side, their margins are pretty thin. They can be wiped out by something like this. I mean, because electricity comes ultimately from a single distributor, and because it is the definition of modern life, if we don't properly control and regulate the business side of this, it can ruin the society while making a few people very rich, cause untold economic damage. It is technically true that in an absolute free market, the market will correct itself. But by the time it does so, it can have destroyed many people's lives, caused countless bankruptcies, caused many people to lose their jobs. There's smarter, better ways to do it, and we figured that out over 100 years ago. And, well, not perfect. We didn't have problems like this before Enron sold the Texas legislature and then 25 more states on their idea of quote-unquote, markets in electricity.
That's how we end up with headlines like this from Business Insider. Texas Army veteran faces $16,000 bill due to rocketing energy prices as billionaire gas producer and Dallas Cowboys owner stands to profit from it. They're always sports owners, I think, David, for some reason. There's always these sports owners who have big energy stakes. They go hand-in-hand.
Well, they make attractive people know who they are in the world of natural gas. You know, mostly people are suits and boring people. People who own a sports team make for good copy, because people know who that person is. If you're in Texas, you know who owns the Cowboys, you know who owns the Mavericks, et cetera.
Let me just work through a couple other points on the subject of Texas and understanding what happened with their energy grid. Charlie in Seneca Falls, so a different Charles, is Charlie in Seneca Falls, says, New York State has gotten rid of local control of the grid. David is correct that you can make an energy-reliant grid, but you have to pay for it, and Texas doesn't want to do that. What do you say to that, David K. Johnston?
That is exactly correct. And by the way, one of the things about the grid is, in order to encourage investment in the grid, and we need new grid lines, that is, new distribution towers and different technology to be stronger and easier to shift power to the extent we're going to rely on wind, regulators have been approving rates of return of 16 or 18%. Well, so you build a $100 million grid, you borrow half the money at 5%, and your only equity is $50 million, you're really getting a 36 or 32%, you have to offset for the interest payments, a 32% return on your $50 million. Money should be flooding into those things. It's not, and I'm not sure I understand why. I've seen some arguments, but I'm not persuaded, and I haven't spent enough time to learn about it.
Here's just a separate journalistic question for you, sort of related but not directly related to energy. It's about journalistic ethics. So we know that Ted Cruz and his family took off and went to Cancun. And Ted Cruz initially lied and said, well, he was just going to make sure that his wife and that his wife and kids got there okay, because that's what you people usually do. They don't trust a mother and a capable woman to fly children. You've got to escort them and make sure they get there okay, and then you turn around and you fly back. I mean, that's what most average citizens do. He lied about that.
Right.
And then he admitted it was a plan to just get out of Texas for a few days and to spend the next few days there, and then he was going to come back. He did come back, essentially turned right around and came back because there was a public outcry. Now, David, the New York Times ended up publishing his wife Heidi Cruz's group text thread, in which she was texting other friends saying, "Do you want to come with us? The kids are going. You know, we're going to go to this high-end resort. We can swim. We can have a good time, get away from the cold." And so the Times published the thread, and there was, you know, there were some journalists who thought that was out of bounds, that, you know, this is the wife of a senator. She's, you know, should you be publishing the group thread even if somebody leaked it to you? How did you feel about that, David?
Well, first of all, the document was provided by somebody who was in the thread. Let's not lose sight
That's
of
right.
that.
That's
and secondly,
right.
this is not any kind of national security secret or anything else. It is the proof that we were lied to by an elected official. I think you have to always think carefully about these things. One of the things I say about journalism, which I got from Cy Hirsch, is at the end of the day, there are no rules. But because you put your name on your work, you have to live with the judgments that you exercise. I would have published it. I wouldn't have hesitated for a minute to publish that. It showed how thoroughly Ted Cruz and his wife were lying. And it adds to the reasons that, as Lindsey Graham once said, if someone shot Ted Cruz dead on the floor of the Senate and the trial of the shooter was held in the Senate, you wouldn't be able to get a conviction. I mean, he is intensely disliked by the other members of the most exclusive club in the world. And this is the kind of reason. You know, a senator has an enormous amount of authority to make things happen. If he had gone to his office locally or just at home and made phone calls, he could have listened to particular problems people had, called and said, "Gee, we really need to get National Guard guys in, you know, someplace nobody was thinking about," and do other actions. So his failure to act tells you that he doesn't even understand the power and ability of a senator to do things that are good for the constituency.
Last question on this subject, and then we'll take a break, and we're going to focus on some other things our listeners are asking about. David, as you know, when there are complex stories like Texas, you've got a story of why a grid was not prepared, why officials did not heed admonitions from regulatory agencies going back decades. You have sort of competing explanations. You've got customers getting gouged. You have what should be a regulatory framework to make sure that those customers are made whole. It's not going to happen. I mean, there's a lot going on here. If only one thing is taken away from this, from the average American understanding what happened in Texas, what do you want it to be?
We need to have public power. It's cheaper and more reliable. Investor-owned power was an important thing to do in the beginning because of the need to raise capital to build power plants. We're in a whole new era, and there is no reason anymore. And there are some leading economists in this field, including ones who work for companies, who will say the same thing, that the time to now have public power run by nonprofits or by governments is here, and there's no reason to have investor-owned utilities. We need to buy out the investors, and by law, what they're entitled to is the net asset value of the company, not the price of their shares. But we should buy them out, and we should have public power that is accountable and whose primary focus is reliability followed by price, not maximization of profits, which is proper for competitive businesses, not these.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the editor-in-chief of DC Report. Let's take this only break, and we're right back with him next. Coming up in our second hour, Governor Andrew Cuomo speaking about the allegations against him and the calls for his resignation. You will hear him talk to journalists about those calls and why he is not resigning, despite calls from his own party for him to do so. Then you will hear former mayor of Rochester, Bill Johnson, weighing in on those calls for resignation. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I just want to mention that we do have word that Governor Andrew Cuomo is going to do a live briefing, as well as what we assume will be a Q&A with journalists at 1 o'clock. And we are going to go ahead and take that live for you. So it may preempt what we have planned for Connections next hour. But we think it's important that you hear that. So the governor will be heard coming up at 1 o'clock here. David K. Johnston, let me ask you about what's happening in, or at least maybe what your take is on what we're hearing from, even from prosecutorial circles here. So Jane Mayer writing for The New Yorker writes that Cyrus Vance Jr., of course, not just announcing he's not going to run for re-election, but her headline is, "Can Cyrus Vance Jr. Nail Trump?" And she writes that insiders say the Manhattan DA's investigation is picking up steam. It's really intensifying in just the last 2 months since Donald Trump left office. One source told her it's like night and day. They mean business. They're trying to work quickly and get things done. And now Vance not running for re-election, so his clock might be ticking. What do you expect to happen there?
Well, remember that this is an investigation largely about the years Donald Trump was a private citizen. And his tax returns, his property tax appeals and statements, his bank loans, his insurance claims, and the business records he keeps. And New York being, you know, the business center of the world, pretty much, business records law is very important in our state. I've been saying for years, Evan, that Donald will, once the authorities get the documents, be indicted. He'll be convicted. What punishment will be meted out will be up to a judge. So we don't know what's going to happen there. And I believe that that's not the only criminal case that Donald Trump will face. Letitia James, our elected attorney general who ran for office promising she would investigate Trump, has a civil investigation going underway that a number of other people besides myself, for example, the famous prosecutor John Moscow, say will result in all likelihood in a New York State racketeering charge. We have a state RICO law. He's under criminal investigation in Fulton County, Georgia, which is basically overlays Atlanta, in which there are tape recordings of him encouraging illegal acts to turn the election in that state in his favor. Apparently several phone calls, maybe numerous phone calls. And so I think Donald Trump is facing a very unfortunate future. The big effort in New York right now, now that they've received these documents, is to turn people. There are no doubt people at the Mazars accounting firm who've done things that make them liable to being prosecuted. And so prosecutors are going to say to those people, well, George, you know, you can spend the next 5 to 10 years in Attica, or you can turn state's evidence. What's it going to be? The key person to turn is Alan Weisselberg, who has been the quote-unquote chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, the money guy, clear back to the 70s when Fred Trump was actively involved in the business. He is so intimately linked to Trump psychologically, it's going to be a real problem for him. But Alan is over 70 and told by prosecutors, you know, your options are turn on Donald and tell the truth or die in prison. One hopes he thinks about his own welfare and because he will have to own up to and allocute to committing many criminal acts on behalf of Donald. One thing listeners should know, Donald Trump's already been tried twice for income tax fraud. They were civil, not criminal trials. But he lost those cases. And in one of the two cases, his own lawyer under oath said that Donald Trump had forged the tax return that was before the court. So it wasn't just a fraudulent tax return. It was one on which he had forged the tax lawyer's signature. That tells you about what a criminal mind Donald Trump has.
Now, David, you spent the first 40 minutes of this program leading us through everything that has gone wrong in Texas with the way that what appears to be a pretty snug set of guidelines and regulations has not been followed. People have been gouged, et cetera. And what looks like is going to happen is that there will be roughly zero consequences, which is a real theme in wrongdoing. I mean, how many people went to prison after the financial crisis, after creating after chopping up subprime mortgages and creating credit default swaps?
Almost nobody.
Yes.
Almost nobody.
So what makes you think that anybody in the Trump family is going to be convicted of anything here, given our country's history with powerful people and leveraging that power in court?
Well, two things to keep in mind. In the case of the collapse in 2008, the guy who knew how to put people in prison, over 800 senior bank savings and loan executives went to prison because of Bill Black, who has ties here to Rochester. Had they brought him in, thousands of people would have gone to prison, but nobody would do that. The Obama administration made a choice. They were not going to prosecute the criminals. They were going to leave them in place. In this case, Donald Trump has lots of people who don't like him. He doesn't have any political power anymore other than raising money. He's a private citizen again. And the ways in which he has defeated law enforcement in the past, he beat four grand juries. He didn't go to jail over sales tax fraud, as Mayor Ed Koch of New York said he should have done. He got away with cheating customers at Trump's Castle Casino, the only known case of the casino cheating players in Atlantic City, a story I broke over 30 years ago. Those circumstances have all changed. And the record of Donald Trump engaging in criminal behavior is all over the public record. Cheating by hiding records and lying under oath, we've had judges find that. Now I think that the winds have simply turned and there was revulsion at his behavior, particularly in New York. I mean, he lost his own voting precinct, which is Trump Tower, pretty much, by a large margin. He'll be indicted. It's possible you'll get a hung jury because one juror will decline to prosecute, but I doubt it. But he's absolutely going to be indicted in Manhattan by Cy Vance and in Fulton County, Georgia. He may end up getting indicted over his effort to overthrow the government of the United States. If a private citizen had said what he said at the rally, and I say this as somebody who's survived six riots and covered lots of violent demonstrations, a private citizen had gotten up and said that, they would absolutely be prosecuted for incitement of riot.
Talking to David K. Johnston, I'll get to phone calls here in just a second. Last point on that is, do you expect any of those developments this calendar year, David?
Oh, I think it's pretty clear that now that they've hired Mark Pomerantz, who is a famous prosecutor and was an extraordinarily skilled defense lawyer in RICO cases, that you're going to see a grand jury issue indictments before Cy Vance leaves office. Yes, I think that's highly likely. I think the same thing in Fulton County, Georgia.
Jim in Rochester is on the phone next with David K. Johnston. Go ahead, Jim.
David, very good. Let me bring up a point. There's the old axiom down in Texas. They said there's the United States of America and then there's Texas. But I want to bring this point up. The gentleman you talked about, Enron, which created this fiasco down there, a guy named Kenneth DeLay was the CEO. And not only were they not using capital for CapEx expenditures, that's capital expenditures, to beef up and ensure that they had a workable grid, they were gambling on the New York Mercantile and the Chicago Board Exchange on futures. And that's one reason why the company went down. That was a major reason. And not only that, Kenneth DeLay, poor fellow, he committed suicide. So everything fell apart down there. So if you want to go to the wild, wild west, just go to Texas. Pick the only city that survived was El Paso, which is down on the Texas-Mexican border, because they're adjacent to Mexico, New Mexico, and Arizona. They were on a different grid, and they never lost power. And I think a couple of the other small cities up in the Texas Panhandle next to Oklahoma, they were on a different grid, and they had electricity throughout that winter storm they had there. So, David, keep the good work up, and you're right. David Cyrus Vance Jr., who's dead, was Cyrus Vance Sr., who was a diplomat, Secretary of State, who negotiated the Paris Peace Accords during the Vietnam War for Lyndon Johnson. He's going to have a stellar career. I can see him eventually running for governor, being a high-ranking government official.
Jim, always appreciate the call. Thank you, sir. Thanks for calling in here. David K. Johnston, anything you want to add there?
No, I think he nailed it right in the head.
Rich in Rochester, next. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Hi, Dave. How you doing? I've always said that there's certain things that should not be a profit motive, things that are life-altering, i.e. electricity, water. There's a difference between efficiency and cutting costs for the sake of cutting costs. If you have a standard and you get efficient as you can in that standard is one thing, but what you find here is always, always cutting costs, always bringing down the quality to the point of breakage. And you did just certain things, I think, and I agree with you on the electricity, and I think it's even coming to the point with the internet in this country. As these become lifebloods, we cannot constantly leave it to companies that are totally unregulated and are profit. I think the electric companies in New York State, they're almost like a nonprofit, even though they make profit, because they can only make so much profit. I think there's got to be a way of doing it. And to Trump, you know, if you're a psychopath, in many ways he fits that term, why would you expect any other behavior from him?
Rich, thank you. David K. Johnston, if you anything you want to add there.
Well, just, you know, one of the things we need to discuss in this country is that not everything ought to be a source of profit. As I mentioned in your show in the past, you know, if we had a nonprofit healthcare system like like France, which has the best system in the world, it would save an amount of money equal to all the income taxes everybody in America paid this year who makes less than $500,000 a year. Now, that's a statistical measure. It's not a real-world measure, but we probably could set the threshold for income taxes at over $100,000 per person if we got away from the model we have now and thought about service instead of maximizing profit. There's nothing wrong with maximizing profit, but let's do it in the areas where it benefits society, not the ones where it doesn't.
Let me try to squeeze in a couple more listener questions. Marion says, what's to prevent New York from having an energy crisis like Texas? David Kay?
Well, we have a better grid, and that's still here. But I think this is a major issue that needs to be seriously studied. And it would be very smart of the state government to have an independent commission evaluate the quality of our grid, the nature of our generating capacity, and to pass a law that you can only own one power plant. Because the market system we have, if you own a fleet of power plants, allows you to manipulate prices and push them upward. But if each group of investors could only own one power plant, or maybe one of each class, because there are little to big ones, short-term to long-term ones, that would go a long way.
Mark says, David, a while back you were working on a new tax system that you felt would be fair, simpler, and harder to cheat. Is this still something you are working on?
I've gone back to working on it. I have a book coming out about Donald Trump. The manuscript is due in a month. It'll be out in September, called The Big Cheat. It's about profiteering during the administration. As soon as that book is done, two things will happen. I'll go back to finishing The Prosperity Tax, which is a very short book, but it has to be very concisely written. And I'm going to start a worldwide television program on IBM TV called The Money and Power Report, Investigating Illicit Deals. There's $40 to $50 trillion of illicit money sloshing around the globe. That's more than twice the total economic activity in the U.S. in the hands of criminals. And I'll be doing this TV show once a week about it from here from my house in Brighton.
Last minute, the late Molly Ivins used to say that when corrupt or incompetent people are running governments at any level, from any party, by the way, she tends not to blame the voters. She says, you know, the instinct is to say, well, these people are led astray, or they're, you know, some pejorative. But she says she always blamed the people in power, and she had affection for their voters, even if she felt the voters had been duped here. David, when you look at what's going on in this country and how divided things are, what do you make of what the late Molly Ivins said about voters, and are you concerned going forward?
Well, I love Molly. I think she was a great, great journalist and had wonderful insights. But on that one, I disagree with her. You know, the whole idea of a democracy is that we choose our fate. And if we choose to elect people who work against our interests and we keep reelecting them, then, you know, we're getting the government we deserve. And she and I disagree about that. If she was still alive, we'd have a great debate about it. But no, Evan, I think, you know, you're responsible for who you elect. The people who elected Greg Abbott should be asking themselves, how did we put this guy in office?
David K. Johnston's a Pulitzer Prize winner, an editor-in-chief of DC Report. David, tell people where to find your work.
DCReportSingular.org. No ads. It's free. It's entirely supported by donors.
No ads, but I love pop.
serious national journalists who worked at the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, the New York Times, the LA Times.
Thank you, David. I love pop-up ads and banners, but I'll allow a site without it. Thank you, David.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. That's David K. Johnston. Governor Andrew Cuomo coming up at 1 o'clock, and you will hear that right here.